since 1985. Dr. Berger has been the University Professor of Sociology and Theology at Boston University and Director of the Institute for the Study of Economic Culture. Professor Berger may be best known for his work on the sociology of knowledge and his profound alternative to the reigning secularization thesis, both of which we'll be asking him about on this program as we try to understand our role as Christians in a post-Christian culture. Dr. Berger, thanks for being with us.
Okay.
The book that you co-authored with Thomas Luckman in 1966, The Social Construction of Reality, A Treatise in the Sociology of Knowledge, became required reading across many disciplines. In fact, you introduced that phrase, social construction, into our vocabulary. As we're working through our context today, you have on one hand René Descartes entering his apartment alone, away from all society, trying to shed himself of all of the opinions he had based on authority, tradition, community, even sense experience, so that he could finally know the absolute truth. And that's sort of the picture we have of the modern search for truth. Then on the other hand, postmodernism, which a lot of people, especially conservative Christians, regard as just another word for relativism. Now, obviously, we're in a major cultural transition, which you've tracked significantly over your career. How do you navigate these extremes?
Well, I mean, look, we tend to think of relativism and fundamentalism as being opposed things. I see them as reverse sides of the same coin. The coin is modernization. And for reasons that can be, they're not mysterious, they can be quite fully explained, modernity brings about a loss of taking for grantedness in terms of what people think the world is like and what they think people should do. One can explain that in great detail, and there are two reactions to it. Relativism, which you mentioned a moment ago, is the kind of embrace of this. There is no truth, or if there is, we can't find it out. There is really no right and wrong. Everything is relative. That's one extreme, which is very destructive, both in terms of society and in terms of individual lives. At the other extreme is fundamentalism, which is most easily, I think, explained as a taking refuge from the relativizing effects of modernity in some claim of absolute certainty, whether it's religious or political. It doesn't have to be religious, it can be anything, which is equally destructive because it means that society is balkanized into groups of people that can no longer talk to each other. One has to find a middle ground, and that's what this book is about. And the middle ground is religious, it's moral, and it, not last, not least, it's political. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's a short try.
Sure, yeah, we'll come back to that a little bit later. Early in your career, you followed, it seems, the secularization thesis held pretty generally in the academy, namely that as the political support for religious institutions fell away, we'd finally graduate from the kindergarten of superstition and dependence on external authorities to the university of reason and autonomy. Now, we still hear that, of course, in the culture, but you're known as the leading critic of that thesis. How did your mind change?
Well, I don't think I ever used the term kindergarten of superstition because I was a Christian then and I'm a Christian now. And that suggests that all religion and Christianity included is a kind of illusion, which I never believed. No, the change of mind was simply, and had nothing to do with any theological or philosophical change. It had to do with my being a social scientist, and that means you look at the evidence. And it became increasingly clear to me, as indeed to most people who work in the field of studying contemporary religion, that the secularization theory was wrong. The evidence was against it. I don't think we live in a post-Christian era at all. Certainly not in the United States, but actually not in most of the world. And it is Christianity that is growing enormously in much of the world. I would say since I changed my mind, which is a long time ago, the obvious mistake of secularization theory has become all the more clear.
Could you describe that in terms that maybe listeners not familiar with your work, A Sacred Canopy or A Room of Angels, other books, could you describe for them a little bit what that secularization thesis is and maybe a couple of reasons why you think it's wrong?
Well, the secularization thesis, basically it says the more modern a society is, the less religious it will be. Some people welcomed this. I mean, that was certainly the belief of the Enlightenment in Europe. As reason and science progress, superstition, which they identified with religion, will decline. That has not happened at all, with two exceptions one could go into in great detail. One is geographical. Western and Central Europe are indeed quite secularized societies. Very interesting question why that is so. And the other one is sociological. There is a kind of international cultural elite which is quite secular. Again, an interesting exception. But most of the world is as religious as it has ever been, and arguably even more so.
Interesting. You distinguish between secularization as, on the one hand, the transfer of politics, economics, and law from the clergy to the laity, sort of something that the Reformation generated.
No, that I wouldn't call secularization at all.
Oh, okay. Secularity, sort of in the broader sense of transferring power from the church to the laity?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say that there are many reasons why this has happened. There is indeed a more an emphasis on the laity. But the main reason for this has to do with not with secularization, but with pluralism. Religious institutions that used to have a monopoly in society lose that monopoly. The Catholic Church in the Western, well, in Europe, is a perfect example of this. Well, as a religious institution loses its monopoly status, it can no longer count on the state to fill its pews. It has to persuade people to come in and to stay in. And that means that there is a shift from power of the religious authorities, the clergy, the hierarchy, whatever, to ordinary people.
So you would define secularization itself as a decline of religious belief and commitment to religious institutions.
Yes, I think that's the usual meaning, and I think it's fine to use it that way.
In his recent book, A Secular Age, Charles Taylor has added another meaning of secularization, namely the reduction of even religion to imminent, just this worldly felt needs. When you look at popular Christianity in America today, especially with the success of books with titles like Your Best Life Now, do you think that churches themselves, to some extent, are contributing to secularization in that sense?
Some are, yes. And I think particularly in mainline Protestantism, there has been a tendency to do what Charles Taylor describes. In other words, to translate the Christian message from having to do with transcendent realities, with God, with life after death, with angels and the whole religious world, translating this into either morality, simply Christianity is the golden rule and nothing else, or a kind of psychotherapy, religion is good for you, it makes you more wholesome, more authentic, or perhaps worst of all, politics, that the religion is about this or that political agenda. Now, all of that is, I would say, is a distortion of what religion in general is, and particularly what the Christian gospel is.
So ironically, in the attempt to make religion more relevant to a culture, in the long run, it makes it more irrelevant.
Oh, absolutely. Dean Inge, who was a rather melancholy Anglican theologian in the, 30s and 40s, put it very well. He who wants to marry the spirit of the age will soon find himself a widower.
A few noted leaders of the evangelical movement have argued that the visible church is even an impediment to one's sort of inner personal relationship with Jesus. Is this part of what sociologists like you call the privatization of the faith that is part of secularization?
Well, privatization is not quite the same as secularization. It suggests that religion has become a matter of personal life and has no public role. But that's also, generally speaking, not the case. Jose Casanova, who's a very good sociologist of religion, he's now a professor at Georgetown University, has written about this in several books in the last few years. And in much of the world, religion is not private. It has a very distinct public role. And that's even true of the United States. We don't have privatization of religion. We have a separation of church and state, to be sure. In fact, a rather strict one compared to other countries. But religion is vibrantly present in the public sphere. People vote on the basis of certain religious beliefs. They express them in politics, in the public arena. So that's not privatization at all.
Do you think in terms of religious authority, though, the idea of anything standing outside of me, whether it's the church, in some cases even the scriptures, is undermined, even in evangelical contexts where it becomes the spirit within?
Well, that is a tradition, actually, within Christianity in general. It's not only evangelicals. I mean, many mystics in Christianity would say something like that. I wouldn't call that secularization. It's something rather different. And I wouldn't hold to that. I'm not evangelical. I'm a Lutheran, which is not quite the same. But what I appreciate about evangelicals is that they understand that the gospel has to do with a interpretation of reality as such. It has to do with God, with redemption, with the resurrection of Christ. It's a transcendent message, cosmic in scope. And that has been much lost in the mainline Protestantism.
Do you think that's still a focus? Are you somewhat concerned about the ongoing witness of evangelicalism vis-a-vis mainline Protestantism on those points?
No, I think evangelical Protestantism is flourishing in the United States, certainly. It's not diminishing in number or in influence, and it's exploding in other parts of the world. In fact, I would say evangelical Protestantism is the most rapidly growing religion globally.
One book I've found especially helpful is The Heretical Imperative, Contemporary Possibilities of Religious Affirmation. Can you tell us what you mean by the heretical imperative and how this aspect of modernity makes it a little tougher to pass on the faith to others, especially successive generations?
Well, the title, in a way, is a play on words. I wrote this quite a few years ago, but I would still say the same thing. Heresy, in the Greek original word, heresis, which is a Greek word for choice. It means that the modern situation forces people to make choices where previously, when religion and worldview was taken for granted, they didn't have to make choices. To be a Christian was a fate, not a choice. And this can be explained rather easily. When you take for granted that Christianity is true, you don't have to make a decision. You're a Christian the way you're an American, or you have hay fever, or you have blonde hair. It's not something you decided upon. When it is no longer taken for granted that you're a Christian, or anything else in the realm of worldview and norms, you have to make decisions. And I think that's a good thing. And what's also very distinctive about evangelicalism is that it puts a decision at the very heart of being a Christian. You're not born a Christian. You have to be born again to be a Christian. Now, I have a little difficulty with what evangelicals mean by being born again. It's a bit too emotional for me. But the core of the message is very clear. Having to make a decision to be a Christian it's the same thing as saying you need faith. And that I find very important and very good.
What are the downsides of, especially in our American culture, of making choice, almost enshrining choice itself, regardless of the object, as a value?
Well, I mean, that is almost inevitable when choice becomes that central in people's lives. And you're right. I mean, choice has become a kind of icon. I mean, feminists or liberals will talk about choice when they mean abortion. Conservatives will talk about choice when they mean homeschooling or charter schools. So choice has become a sort of okay word. That has problems, I think you're right. But on the other hand, the basic fact that what previously was taken for granted now has to be freely chosen, I don't deplore.
Another phrase you've introduced into our general vocabulary is plausibility structures. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's I coined that phrase. I'm proud of it. I like it. I embrace it. But when I die, inscribed on my heart will be the word plausibility structure. No, what I mean is actually it's an old sociological insight, which I think is valid, that what we believe to be true or good depends very much on the consensus of people who surround us and who are important for us. So every statement about the world, except maybe things that are directly accessible to our senses, requires social confirmation. I don't need social confirmation to know that I have a toothache. That fact imposes itself upon me whether I'm surrounded by, no matter who I'm talking to. But most of what I consider to be my values or my worldview depends on a social consensus of those around me. Which is really another way of saying, which is not a new truth, that human beings are social beings. We become what we are through socialization, through social processes, and we remain what we are because there are people around us, important to us, who say, that's what you are.
This is exactly the sort of thing Descartes wanted to divest himself of, right? And a lot of modernists in the Enlightenment get rid of all those prejudices.
No, I don't know. I'm not an expert on the history of philosophy. Was Descartes? I don't know. I'll take your word for it. If he tried to get rid of it, he was wrong.
Well, can you apply this idea of plausibility structures to the practical lives of Christians in families, churches, and wider society? In other words, does the actual participation of a believer in a community with its practices of preaching, baptism, communion, public prayer and singing, fellowship and outreach, do all of these practices, this sort of network, create its own plausibility structure for successive generations to be raised in the Christian faith? And what happens if we abandon these external structures and practices as sort of stifling to the individual quest?
Oh, I would say the short answer to that question is yes. And you can put it in general terms, in sociological terms, that for any statement about the world, for any value, any belief to survive over time, it requires an institution, because solitary individuals can't do this. And especially when you're talking about passing something from one generation to another. Children require a community within which they can grow up and believe certain things and live in a certain way. So I think the necessity of a community for a Christian faith is I would assume that I would take that as given. It has to be that way.
It's not something you can do over the Internet.
I doubt it. But of course, choice remains here in a very important way, because especially in a society where there is religious freedom, you can choose that community. And even if you are born into, you know, religion A, you are free to change into religion B or to redefine what you mean by religion A. So choice enters into that as well. But I think the choice to be a Christian all by yourself is a very difficult one.
Professor Berger, you've written a lot on globalization in recent years. How has globalization affected our consciousness, especially with respect to competing religious claims?
Well, I think it has meant that unless we live in a cave somewhere, we become much more aware of how many different religious possibilities there are in the world. Again, that goes back to the heretical imperative. If you live in a mountain village where everybody around you is a Tibetan Buddhist, the idea that Tibetan Buddhist may possibly not be quite the ultimate truth may not even occur to you. But as soon as you come down from your mountain village into a city where you get everything under the sun living next door, you have to make a choice. And even if your choice is, well, I'm going to be a Tibetan Buddhist for the rest of my life, that's a choice. It's no longer taken for granted. So I think globalization, if you want to take my old term again, globalization has increased the heretical imperative and continues to do so, and I wouldn't deplore that.
So everybody has to make a choice. That's the one thing that has changed for everybody, from fundamentalists to secularists.
Nearly everyone. I mean, there are some people who live in some Tibetan village on the top of a mountain, but there aren't very many of those.
In 2003, you wrote Questions of Faith, A Skeptical Affirmation of Christianity. How would you describe your own relationship to Christian faith and practice today?
Well, that was my fullest statement of where I stand theologically, and you can describe it if you like. First of all, it's Christian. And it's Christian in a fairly traditional sense. The meaning of Christianity can be expressed fully in one sentence, which is Christ is risen. The rest is commentary, which obviously can be hundreds of books and articles and statements, but that is what it's all about. And then I think that's something that's shared by people in different Christian communities, from Eastern Orthodoxy to Evangelical Protestantism and everything in between. Beyond that, I mean, I would describe myself as a Lutheran. That's my background. And so I guess I would have to say I'm on the liberal side of the Lutheran view of Christianity.
One final question, Dr. Berger. In terms of the social construction of reality, how do all pervasive features of our life today, such as technology and the commodification of reality, shape or misshape religious communities? I know that's a huge question, but if you could take a couple of examples.
Gee, I don't know. Look, what in terms of what we've been discussing for the last 20 minutes or so, I mean, what technology does is it makes it much easier for everybody to talk to everybody else. So, I mean, if you want one picture of the world today, the most powerful one is somebody with a cell phone. Some years ago, I was in Hong Kong, and I happened to walk into a Buddhist temple, and there was a guy in a business suit who held an incense stick in one hand and was talking as a cell phone on the other hand. I think he was not talking to the Buddha. He was talking to some friend of his. Well, that's the picture of the globalized world. Huh. Everyone talks to everyone else, and that means people increasingly become exposed to alternative norms and values and worldviews. Now, that can be quite disturbing. I mean, people can get seasick from all of this. On the other hand, I think most people manage somehow, and they find, as you said a moment ago, they find a community which sustains them and supports them in the choices they make.
One of the things I think that you've forever changed the landscape on is this sense that it's not all theory, it's also practices. Of course, you have predecessors saying that as well, but that you've really focused it for a lot of us on the sociology of knowledge. Do you think that there's a danger in thinking, on the one hand, that truth is only about practices? We're shaped completely by our being, you know, white middle class males growing up in Orange County, versus on the other extreme, we're just disembodied minds, and we need to see ourselves as part of a context that has shaped us, not just that we have sort of drilled down to reality, but we're also part of a particular time and place that has shaped us. Is that really important for us as Christians to understand?
Well, I think it's important to understand, yes. And look, there are, if you are a white middle-class person growing up, having grown up in Orange County, obviously that shapes a lot of what you are. And you are not a Tibetan Buddhist who lives in a mountain village, okay? But on the other hand, certainly in the American situation today, whether it's in Orange County or anywhere else, that accident of birth does not determine the rest of your life. And you can move out, in fact, large numbers of people move out of the background which originally shaped them. So I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. Of course we are not disembodied free minds floating in a sort of social vacuum. That's a mistake. That's not what life is really like. On the other hand, we are not the robots. We are not We don't come out of a mint of our background that, you know, we are stamped with us in a certain way of, in childhood and then have to stay that way for the rest of our lives. It's some truth is in between. We have a degree of freedom, and the degree can be considerable.
Professor Berger, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to help us out with these big questions on the White Horse Inn.
Good. It was very nice talking to you.